It's official, Constant listeners, we are in summer. I hope everyone had an enjoyable Memorial Day weekend, and more importantly, hope we all had a chance to think about what the day's really about. It's easy to lose sight of it when the weather's great and the weekend's long and everyone's busy having a great time. But there is a serious, sober rationale for the holiday that we all need to keep in mind. Okay, this week's sports dedication is going to serve as a bookend to a prior dedication, or maybe more appropriately, a yin to a prior dedication yang, an alter ego, perhaps. Back in episode 121, about 9 months ago, we dedicated the episode to UCLA coaching legend John Wooden and all the positives that he stood for over his 99-year life. But there was an alter ego to John Wooden who lived and worked in the shadows, walked up to the lines, and may have crossed more than one of them. And without this person, UCLA basketball never would have accomplished on the court what it did. Our dedication for this episode doesn't get enough attention as a warning to how things can go astray if you don't stay committed to clear, sound values. His name is Sam Gilbert, and I'm sure a healthy majority of Constant listeners don't know that name. But his story, as to what he impacted, is one that most people are familiar with. And the lesson his story provides is useful to all of us in business, sports, and life. Now, John Wooden, of course, was the visible father figure of UCLA basketball during its dynastic run on the hardwood, and he was the face of the program in front of the cameras. But Sam Gilbert, he was UCLA's behind-the-scenes fixer and finagler that built the dynasty off the court, and he didn't always follow NCAA rules. You don't truly understand the UCLA basketball dynasty of the 60s and 70s without understanding Gilbert. Sam Gilbert was a self-made man, grew up in Hollywood, not far from the UCLA campus, and he was also active in the civil rights movement. He attended UCLA in the 1930s, but he didn't graduate, and he later made his fortune as a contractor. And if he liked you, he was the sweetest of men. And if you got in his way, he had a dark side that would run right over you. And Sam Gilbert, he loved one thing in life above all others, the basketball Bruins. And the UCLA hoops players of that era, they didn't like Gilbert. They adored and worshipped him. He was their mentor in life, while Wooden was their mentor on the court. And that's the harsh reality. Gilbert was in some ways corny. He would show up after Bruins games in the 1960s, handing out fruit and apples and oranges, etc., to players and staff. He'd hold dinners at his home, and he'd provide UCLA players with advice, counsel, and much, much more. As in the type of more that NCAA rules strictly prohibited, and the type of more that would make many of us cringe. Gilbert, during Wooden's heyday, helped players get cars, clothes, airline tickets, and scalper's prices for UCLA season tickets allotted to the players. Gilbert allegedly even arranged abortions for players' girlfriends. An NCAA rules nightmare, to be sure. But Gilbert considered NCAA rules stupid, and he ignored them, while Wooden touted the program's squeaky clean image. Gilbert was once defined as a one-man clearinghouse who has enabled players and their families to receive goods and services, usually at a big discount and sometimes at no cost. That was one specific description of him. But you know, his dedication, actions, and deeds, no matter the ethical or legal consequences, those things ended up building incredibly strong bonds with UCLA players. Players, by the way, who won 10 national championships from the mid-1960s to the mid-1970s, all during the Wooden era. Gilbert was known as Papa Sam to UCLA superstars. Larry Farmer, who played for Wooden and later became head coach at UCLA himself, remarked of Gilbert, "I saw him move mountains." He was so trusted by the star players that he actually negotiated pro NBA and other contracts for the big-name players and would charge only a dollar as a fee. Take one of the stars, Lucius Allen, and his word for it. Allen was a key part of the 1960s Bruins championship teams. And here's a cool trivia fact about him. He's one of the few basketball players to win a state high school title, an NCAA national championship with the Bruins, of course, and an NBA title with the Bucks. Anyway, Allen once said, "There were two people I listened to. Coach Wooden, as long as we were between the lines. Outside the court, Sam Gilbert." Now, where was Coach Wooden when all this was going down? many said Wooden was wary of Gilbert. But as we see time and again in business, in politics, in life, Wooden generally turned a blind eye. Wooden, in 1981, said, "There's as much crookedness as you want to find. There was something Abraham Lincoln said. He'd rather trust and be disappointed than distrust and be miserable all the time. Maybe I trusted too much." Again, that was from John Wooden himself. And how about this from the Wizard of Westwood, as Wooden was known decades after his retirement, on the Gilbert situation? "I tried my best. My conscience is clear." LA Times investigative reporters, they were not as forgiving with Wooden's lax attitude. The reporting pair of Litwin and Greenberg stated, "Wooden knew about Gilbert. He knew the players were close to Gilbert. He knew they looked to Gilbert for advice. Maybe he knew more. He should have known much more. If he didn't, it was only because he apparently chose not to look." That's from the LA Times. Gilbert's actions finally caught up to UCLA and landed the basketball program on NCAA probation, but that was after Wooden was long retired. In 1981, UCLA was cited for 9 infractions. They received 2 years probation. That included a 1-year NCAA tournament ban and an order to vacate its 1980 NCAA national title game appearance against Louisville. The NCAA ordered UCLA to dissociate Gilbert from its recruiting process, and none of the violations were tied to Wooden's era. Gilbert died in 1987, and 4 days before he passed away, that is 4 days before federal prosecutors, who were unaware of his passing, they indicted him for racketeering and money laundering outside of basketball, something to do with marijuana smuggling and funding a casino. Wooden once said to Gilbert, "Maybe I had tunnel vision. I still don't think he's had any great impact on the basketball program." Sorry, Coach Wooden, but no Sam Gilbert, no UCLA dynasty. Just like if no John Wooden, no UCLA basketball dynasty. As I said, Gilbert is an alter ego in the yang to Wooden's yin dedication. You don't have one's history without the other, sad to say. And there's a life lesson in this dedication for all of us. Watch who you associate with. They set your legacy sometimes as much as you do, whether it's going to be for the better or for the worse. The dedication we just covered involved the situation where clear-cut rules existed for NCAA athletes and teams, then someone brazenly decided to ignore the rules and break them, and then the system, whether it's the UCLA leadership, the NCAA, or law enforcement, chose to ignore the breaking of the rules. At least it did for decades, after the initial infractions were known of or should have been known of. Now that serves as an excellent opening for a connection into our next topic, the current situation across our nation with prosecutors in public office and what's guiding those district attorneys' decisions and performance when enforcing or choosing not to enforce the law, and then the rise of crime. There was an interesting piece and analysis performed by Collie Stimson of the Heritage Foundation that I read recently and I wanted to share with you. It's fascinating stuff. The analysis started with what I thought was an interesting question. What happens when district attorneys, who are part of each state's executive branch of government, refuse to execute the laws of the city or the state or the nation? That question seems illogical at first because most of us assume the district attorneys will consistently and clinically look to enforce the law via their prosecution decisions. But when you look around wide swaths of the nation today, you quickly understand that this question is an important one because there are scores of district attorneys that today are consciously deciding to ignore the law and to not enforce it. And doing so has consequences, as we shall see. Now, to start, don't confuse two different issues on this topic, which many people do. We're not debating which laws on the books are good ones and which ones are bad ones. That's a legitimate series of questions or debates, but it's not this issue at hand. Instead, this issue is about what happens if an elected member of the executive branch of government, a district attorney or a prosecutor, refuses to follow the laws passed by the legislature. That's a check and balance and branch of government issue, just to be clear. Okay, first, recognize the elected district attorney. It's a big deal, and it's a very important role. There are roughly 2,300 elected district attorneys across the United States, And almost 90% of criminal cases in America are handled by those district attorneys. So the social contract demands that the district attorney consistently and fairly enforce state criminal laws to protect citizens' safety and citizens' rights. Shouldn't matter if you're a Democrat or Republican, a libertarian like myself, left-leaning or right-leaning. As the district attorney, you clinically do your job by faithfully executing the code of the criminal justice system. Now, when district attorneys do that, crime tapers and society benefits. Crime had peaked in the early 1990s, but with a focus on criminal justice and with district attorneys efficiently performing their jobs, over the next 30 years, crime was steadily reduced. And in many ways, New York City itself proved to be the ultimate example of that trend. But that changed about 10 years ago. And a lot of people blame George Soros and his funding of progressive prosecutors, which is code for prosecutors who don't prosecute. And the opponents of the progressive prosecutor movement, they refer to them as rogue prosecutors. And hey, you know, Soros, by some accounts, poured tens of millions of dollars into the campaigns of progressive prosecutors. But to blame one individual or their bank account, it belies a much more complex and much more widespread problem. It's not just that person or that funding source. The progressive prosecutor movement believes that the criminal justice system is broken, and the only way to fix it is to replace law and order district attorneys with soft on crime and anti-police district attorneys. And when you do that, a community is going to suffer an epidemic of crime and decreased quality of life. And it will hit the working poor and hit minorities harder, which are the very groups the progressives claim to be advocating for. The progressive prosecutor movement was a very methodical and well laid out campaign, which unfortunately is often a hallmark of the left. The left plays a long game in campaigns methodically, and most citizens and voters don't even know who their district attorney is. So in some ways, it's a bit of an invisible, off the radar position. But again, it holds enormous power if you're looking to impact the criminal justice system and law and order in either direction, because the prosecutors, not the police, they're the true gatekeepers of the criminal justice system. District attorneys decide whether charges are filed and which charges to file. If you put in prosecutors with the desired ideology of the left, you could reverse engineer and dismantle the existing criminal justice system without a single change in law. There are constitutional implications, of course, of doing so. The state legislature, that's the entity that determines what the law is, or supposed to be determining what the law is. But a prosecutor who refuses to prosecute categories of crimes that are on the books in their state violates the separation of powers between the executive branch, which is where the prosecutor resides, and the legislative branch of government. Prosecutors and district attorneys, they don't have the power to redefine crime and punishment. The legislature does. When you refuse to prosecute a certain crime, you're in effect repealing criminal statutes, and that usurps the power vested with the legislature. The left in the progressive prosecutor movement, they understood that, and they invested tremendous resources into low visibility elections for county district attorneys, and it worked. Or, on a, as a ZZ Top song would put it, nationwide scale. And now those progressive prosecutors, they change quality of life across a huge segment of the American population. The examples and the data tell the story, which we'll review now shortly. Understand the scale when it comes to the progressive or rogue prosecutor movement, whichever term you prefer, across the nation. There's more than 70 such individuals in America today, and they represent more than 70 million people, which is roughly 1 in 5 Americans. So this is not a one-off or small-scale issue, and it concentrates in big city urban regions. Now let's go to those examples that I alluded to. The first case in point is Boston. A former district attorney there posted a list of 15 misdemeanors the county office would not prosecute. Things like trespassing, shoplifting, disturbing the peace, and operating a vehicle with a suspended or revoked license. And also possession with intent to distribute illegal drugs. What type of message do you think that sent to the citizenry and the perpetrators of crime? Or how about the district attorney of Los Angeles County out in California? He wrote a directive to his army of 1,000 prosecutors saying that over a dozen misdemeanors, and this is using the prosecutor's terms, shall be declined or dismissed before arraignment and without conditions. He did attach certain exceptions that would apply, but he also added that those dozen plus misdemeanors were not an exhaustive list, and that each prosecutor within his office would have the discretion to decline any of the hundreds of other misdemeanors in the California Code that fall within what he referenced as the spirit of his directive. My goodness, you talk about sowing chaos. Then there is Chicago. And that was the first big city in the nation that saw a progressive prosecutor in office. When she took office, she decided to raise the threshold for prosecuting shoplifting from $300 per incident to $1,000 per incident. Now, Mr. Stimson, in his essay and his work, referenced that as basically declaring open season on retailers in Chicago. That was the phrase that he used, which is exactly, by the way, what happened. And I must mention a city in my state, Philadelphia. The district attorney there, when elected back in 2018, celebrated election night by referencing himself as a public defender with power. And on his first day, he fired over two dozen experienced violent crime prosecutors, and he referred to them as ticks. Now, those are the example cities. What do the data say as to how quality of life and crime have trended in these types of case studies? Not surprisingly, crime has exploded. Quality of life has been shattered. And we talked about San Francisco's and the Bay Area's demise a few weeks ago on the far middle. And San Francisco, by the way, had its own run-in with a progressive district attorney. And I just mentioned Philadelphia. Before their progressive district attorney was elected, there was an average of 271 homicides per year. Since his election, there's been an average of 457 homicides per year. Think of the human toll cumulatively. Non-fatal shootings in Philly have increased nearly 50%. Retail theft is also up, and auto theft is way up in the city of brotherly love. Now, Chicago, we know that that city is a mess. Since its progressive district attorney took over in 2017, the average number of homicides per year went from just over 500 to 660. Chicago's annual murder rate on a per capita basis, it easily and greatly exceeds the fatality rates of combat troops in both Iraq and Afghanistan. And that is not something that Chicagoans or Americans should be comfortable with. Now, there is hope that Americans and voters are catching on. Baltimore and the aforementioned San Francisco, they've ousted their progressive prosecutors. St. Louis and Boston, they saw theirs resign because of some controversy. And then the LA progressive prosecutor has been under constant fire of late. Perhaps the point in bringing this issue to the far middle is to remind all of us that when you go into the voting booth, you got to pay particular attention to some of those offices and races that most people, frankly, don't think much about. And which option you check on the ballot could have quite an impact on your quality of life and personal safety and those around you. And of course, the prerequisite to thinking that through and making an informed choice is committing yourself to going to vote to begin with. Now, that covers our far middle civics moment for the week. The discussion of rogue or progressive district attorneys, as I said earlier, at the heart of it, it's a constitutional matter involving separation of powers and checks and balances within the branches of government. And that ties and makes a very nice connection into an ongoing, consistent theme of the far middle, the ballooning and out-of-control administrative state, an administrative state that's grown out of the executive branch of government. Too often in today's United States, and not just with district attorneys and criminal law, the administrative power is the executive branch's way of ripping away and evading legislative and judicial power the Constitution granted. You make law in the legislative branch, Congress in the case of the federal government, you adjudicate the law in the judicial branch, and then the executive branch executes the law. Today's administrative state, its agencies and its district attorneys, they all see it quite differently. Regulations not spelled out in statute, wild interpretations of law, and selective execution of laws, these things create a free-for-all with administrative power in the bureaucratic state. And that free-for-all mentality creates unaccountability and lack of consistency, which might be great for the bureaucrat or the regulator or the district attorney, but it creates chaos and strife for the rest of us. And this flexing of administrative power is dangerous and damaging. It diminishes the value of voting. Congress or the state legislature, which includes, by the way, your representatives within our Western Republican democracy, they never voted for many of our current regulations or non-enforcement of laws in the case of district attorneys. The flow of power was supposed to be from the citizen in the voting booth to the elected legislature, to the law, to the executive branch that executes the law. That's all been short-circuited today, and now it's the faceless and often unelected bureaucrat that has free rein to make up the law as desired and to ignore the law that is on the books to the extent desired, facing no accountability when doing either. Worse, when the bureaucrat or the rogue prosecutor commands what they don't have the authority to command, our elected representatives, they shirk their duty to step in and either pass law or demand that the law that's been passed be followed. And the judicial branch is a much better. It punts when it comes to saying what the law actually is and requires. So the other branches of government, they're not pushing back and doing their jobs. It's not a small problem. It's a massive problem. It's not a shrinking concern. It's a growing concern. And it's no longer something that's impacting just corners of society. It is now something that is impacting all of society. It's a theme that the far middle has been discussing for years, and it's one growing worse by the episode. Episode 158, just about in the books. How can we conclude with a neat tucked-in connection that seamlessly links to the themes discussed? I think I have the answer. Let's close with the connection discussing some of the more famous songs in rock history to deal with breaking the law and its consequences, assuming progressive or rogue district attorneys start to do their jobs. Now, there are two singles that come to mind with committing crime. One is the classic, I Fought the Law. You know the rest of the lyric, right? And the law won. The history of that single is extensive and impressive. Check it out. Written by Sonny Curtis of the Crickets and popularized by a cover by the Bobby Fuller Four. And then it became a top 10 hit for the band in 1966, but then a version by Sam Neely charted in 75, and the song was also recorded by The Clash in 1979, and a version with different lyrics was recorded by the punk act Dead Kennedys in 1978. People just love covering that song. Then there is Breaking the Law by heavy metal pioneer band Judas Priest. I'm a long-standing Judas Priest fan, and that single is off of what I believe to be the band's greatest album, British Steel from 1980, which also offers one of the greatest covers in the history of album art. Check it out. Pictures can be very powerful. But let's think this through. If you do what the Bobby Fuller Four or The Clash or Judas Priest sang about, then in a stable society, there's going to be a consequence. And perhaps you'll be sentenced to 30 Days in the Hole, which was a great song by the iconic rock group Humble Pie from 1972. But if you don't want to spend 30 days in the hole, then maybe it's time for a jailbreak. And Jailbreak is the title of songs from two rock groups who may be the greatest rock acts from their respective countries. And both Jailbreak singles came out in 1976. How about that? The first version of Jailbreak is from Thin Lizzy from Ireland. And for those U2 fan constant listeners like myself, who consider U2 the greatest band in Irish history, consider that in a recent poll, the Irish rock fans assigned that honor to Thin Lizzy. Now, the other band who recorded a song with the title Jailbreak in 1976 was none other than AC/DC from Australia. That song is a very underrated gem from the early version of AC/DC with the one and only Bon Scott on lead vocals. And that's off the Dirty Deeds Done Dirt Cheap album. But I should warn you, when committing or attempting a jailbreak, you better think things through and make a clean getaway, because if you don't, you're caught, you could be headed for the gallows pole. And that's a song by Led Zeppelin on Led Zepp 3, which came out in 1970. Gallows pole has a lineage even longer than the one for I Fought the Law. It's originally an ancient traditional folk song covered in many years and epochs of time and by many different artists throughout the ages. Jimmy Page and Robert Plant were primarily influenced by two versions of the song, a 1939 version by Leadbelly and a 1962 version by Fred Gerlach. The Led Zepp version of Gallows Pole is the only song from the group that included a banjo. Did you know? Go ahead and try to find another Led Zeppelin song deploying a banjo, I dare you. Now, while you're searching those sonic archives, I'll be thinking about a compelling set of connections for next week. Till then, stay safe.